Hello. In recent audio snippets, we have been talking about the 10 pillars that will serve as the foundation of the new American Constitution, and we've been focusing recently on pillar number 8, which will be which is the right to property. And we have been going over some of the principles inside that right, unfortunately, we're going to repeat some things again, and I find it interesting that I felt the need to repeat things over and over again when describing this particular right, because for reasons that go outside the scope of this or the immediate scope of this audio clip, the right to property, this eighth pillar, is related to the concept of repetition. But the reason for that is it's too long to explain here. But so I think it is fitting that we're repeating things so much when trying to describe this right, and we've done so inadvertently. But there's a reason for it. So let's go quickly over some of the things we have already said, to add and refine some details along the way. The first thing that we mentioned before that would be part of this eighth pillar, this right to property, is the right to acquire property through work or effort. We mentioned that the emphasis is through work and effort. The right to property does not give me a right to a house, just as Polio Boy FDR said in his last State of the Union address in 1944. I don't have the right to things being given to me by the government or by other rich people just because. I have the right to acquire property, but obviously that involves me putting work and effort into it in order to acquire that property, but I have this fundamental right to pursue the acquisition of property. And after I have put in honest work and effort, then I can claim property. And once it's mine, I've claimed it and have paid for it, then it is mine. And it's not on loan. It's not that the government's allowing me to have this for a time. No, it's mine. And that's a very fundamental concept in the right to property. But the thing I wanted to go over quickly is the first part. We focused on the second part of that that phrase or sentence, but it's important to emphasize a little bit the first part. In other words, the acquiring of property. Now, the right to property comes into play the moment you have paid with your work and effort and you obtain the property, whatever you worked for. But the acquisition of that property, that part of it falls slightly outside the scope of the right to property per se. And I would dare say that if you had to associate it with any right, that first part goes more with the sixth pillar, the right to life. In other words, the right to life, which is the right to freedom, the right to liberty, to exercise your free will. So whilst acquiring the property, I will exercise my right to life. In other words, I say, okay, what do I want to do? I want to be a surgeon. I want to be a teacher. I want to be a lawyer. I want to be a physician or whatever you want to do. You decide on what you want to do and you embark on it. And after you've put in the effort, then you acquire a salary or property or whatever is the payment for your effort. But to do that, to acquire that property, I had to exercise my right to life. Now, the right to life means that I can decide what I want to do, and that means doing a million different things or possibilities. And that means that some of those possibilities might involve things that are not rightful or correct. For example, if someone decides, oh, okay, I want to acquire property, I have, according to the Constitution, the eighth pillar, the right to own property, that's my one of my fundamental human rights, and I will pursue this right or work of in terms of this right, and I will go and steal a car and or rob a bank, let's say, and I'm going to thereby acquire property, the money inside the bank. And to do that, I get together with some other friends and we start planning the heist, and we case the place, we look at where the cameras are, we set things up, we analyze the blueprint of the building and everything, we analyze who comes in and out at what times of the day. So it takes a lot of effort, a lot of work, a lot of planning, and then you carry out the plan and you rob the bank. And if you're successful, you get away with a whole bunch of money. And you would say, well, isn't that therefore an example of the right to property? Well, the problem is that whilst you were robbing the bank, you were violating the right to property of somebody else whilst exercising your right to life. So because you were exercising your right to life in an improper way, then whatever you acquired, quote unquote, from that effort is not valid. It never became your property. So because it never became your property, then the right to property does not come in. So if the police catch you, they can take that money away from you because it was really never yours to begin with. In the same way, if I kill someone to take their money, or if I do some sort of Ponzi scheme to swindle people out of their life savings, that takes a lot of effort and a lot of work, a lot of planning on how to deceive people. But whilst doing that, I'm violating their right to life, the right to property, and who knows what other rights. Whatever I quote acquire from that is not protected by the right to property, my human right to property, because it was never mine to begin with. It never entered my realm of ownership in the proper sense of the word. So you can say that in that first concept that we delineated in our list to describe the right to property, that first concept is kind of the linkage between the right to life and the right to property. So you exercise your right to life, you do things, and in doing that, if your effort is correct, then you acquire it, and then it becomes yours, and then whatever you acquired becomes protected by the right to property. And that means that as you're exercising your right to life, you might do something that is not correct, that's not proper, where you're violating someone else's rights. And the moment you start violating other people's rights, then you are not truly acquiring whatever you acquired, supposedly, and it's therefore not protected by the right to property. And that subtle distinction illustrates a peculiar quality about this right. That in a sense, the right to property, as we've also mentioned before, is a bit of a passive right, whereas along with the right to privacy, the seventh pillar, the seventh and the eighth pillars, the right to privacy and the right to property are passive rights in the sense that they are kind of inward looking. You know, the right to privacy is, you know, you close your door and you look within you. You're within your own private zone. It's inward looking, it's passive. And the right to property has that quality as well. You know, something enters into your ownership, it enters into your private realm of ownership, and it's inward looking and it's passive. You know, you can have money in the bank. It's just sitting there. It's yours. You're exercising your right to property, even though the money's not moving or doing anything. You can have money under your pillow, cushion, or under your bed, or your mattress. It's just sitting there. It's passively sitting there. But whilst it's sitting there, you're exercising your right to property over it. So there's a passive quality to it. And interestingly, if you stay within the circle of that right, you are basically guaranteed in a sense that you're not violating the right of anyone else. And that's I know that sounds like a very ethereal or kind of academic point, but I think it's important to point it out that the right to privacy and the right to property being passive and being eternal mean that whilst exercising that right, whilst living within the boundaries of those two rights, you are basically guaranteed that no one can accuse you of violating anybody else's rights. In other words, if you stay inside your house all day, you know, you're exercising your right to privacy, you're a very private person, you don't mess with anyone, no one messes with you, you just stay in your house. Unless you own the house or you pay the rent on time, so you know you have the right to be there, you're not bothering anybody, then you can't be violating anybody's rights because you're inside your house. You're not going around killing people, you're not violating the right to life, you're not robbing anyone, so you're not violating the right to property, you're not doing anything. So in that sense, the right, you cannot violate the rights of others whilst you're fully exercising those two rights, as opposed to the other three. We've already discussed the right to life, and we'll discuss the other two rights, the ninth and the tenth pillars. The right to life and the other two pillars that we haven't discussed yet, they are more active and outward looking. And that means that whilst you're exercising those rights, you can infringe on the rights of others. So like if I'm exercising my right to life and I use that right to life to go and kill someone else, then I'm obviously violating the right to life of that other person. I know that that's a very subtle differentiation, but from a legal standpoint, whilst defining the laws of the land, that differentiation is very, very important. If I cannot be accused of violating anybody's rights by the mere virtue of me holding my property. In other words, no one can come and say, you are violating the right to life of the poor people in Africa who are starving to death because you have all this money and you haven't given it away to them. And therefore, we accuse you of crimes against humanity and we're going to take your property away from you. Because you should be sharing that wealth with the poor people around the world. And how dare you keep that money to yourself? That is an invalid and unconstitutional statement. Any law that kind of hints of that would be unconstitutional because it's saying that you, by simply holding on to your property, your money, you are violating the rights of other people. And that cannot happen with that right to property and the right to privacy. If you're doing something in private, as long as it stays within the confines of your privacy, you cannot be accused of violating the rights of others. There's a difference. We explained, for example, with in the case of the right to privacy, that if someone goes out naked out in the street and on a public street, not a nudist beach or anything like that, then they are trying to force everybody else into their private zone and thereby violating the right to privacy of others because they are forcing you to enter into a private zone that you're probably not interested in participating in. And if there are children around, then you're violating their right to right because of their innocence. And we described all that in detail before. The concept of innocence and privacy are also very, very strongly related. But that is different from you just exercise your right to privacy in your legal private zone. And if you exercise that within your private zone, you're not bothering anybody else. No one can come and accuse you of having broken any law or violated any right if you are within your own privacy zone. And that's why it's important to clarify that the right to privacy is not a shield to protect wrongdoing. So if you're in your privacy zone, let's say you're in your house and there's a guest and you kill the guest, even though the guest is inside your privacy zone, you cannot use your privacy to shield you from the law and say, hey, he was in my house, so I had the right to kill him because he was in my privacy zone. No. Because the right to privacy can only shield our vulnerability, our nakedness, our weaknesses, not our wrongdoing. And that is the problem in the current American constitutional system. We've repeated that several times, how again and again, people in the legal business, prosecutors are constantly having to fight the right to privacy, and how lawyers have taken advantage of that right to privacy to shield their clients, their criminal clients, from judgment. So the right to privacy becomes this pastoral shield against judgments, against rightful judgments against criminals. But under the new American Constitution, as we've defined it, the right to privacy cannot be used for that at all. And that also affects the way lawyers interact with their clients under the new American Constitution. A lawyer cannot have an open conversation with a criminal where the criminal is confessing to the crime and telling him where the body is and that and the other, and then have the lawyer say to the police or to the prosecution, hey, I can't tell you anything he said to me because that's under attorney-client privilege. No, it cannot be shielded under that. If there is a problem, but then you say, oh, how can you mount a good defense if you don't let the client, if you don't know all the details of the situation because the client cannot be open and honest with you? Well, that's his problem. If he really committed a crime, then why are we making such an effort to help him cover up the crime? If under the new American Constitution, one of the changes would be that if an attorney finds out, like O.J. Simpson's attorneys, they know he really did kill Nicole Brown, and let's say O.J. Simpson told them exactly how he did it, then they would have no choice, especially being officers of the court officially, to go and expose what the client did. They can't say, okay, now thank you for letting us know how you did it, because now we have to look for loopholes and way to cover up what you did. And it's important that you tell us how everything happened so that we can then use that to see if we can plug holes into the narrative that the prosecution is claiming of how you committed the crime. Because if we know you slashed her 5 times and the police say that you slashed her 7 times, we can catch them on a lie and some technicality. So that's how the right to privacy has been used. And there'd be none of that. Now, the problem is the only situation where it seems like it would be kind of reasonable for the lawyer to conspire with the client to shield him from the law is if the law is inherently evil. So, and it's obviously like in the case of, Anne Frank's protectors during World War II, if the Nazis come knocking on the door and say, hey, do you have any Jews in here? If they say, hey, no Jews here, man, even though there are Jews in the basement or in the attic or wherever they are, then you wouldn't say he should have been honest, and privacy cannot be used to shield wrongdoing, and they are committing a crime against the state by taking in Jews and protecting them from Nazi extermination. In that case, we have an unrighteous law, and therefore the privacy of that home can be used to protect the Jews because they're being protected from a law that is unrighteous. But then the problem is the law. So then what we have to do is deal with the unjust law, not treat all laws as unjust, and then allow criminals to shield themselves from all these laws. So I hope that that makes sense. So we don't want the criminals to protect themselves from righteous laws through the right to privacy. We want to have them be exposed at every turn, and nothing can cover them up, no marital confidentiality, no priest confidentiality, no lawyer lawyer-client privilege, none of that. And if they have to kind of dance around the truth and not tell their lawyer what really happened, in order to avoid exposing themselves, then, you know, if that limits their defense, well, awesome, you know, because that means that they will get convicted of the crime they did commit. Now, if they did really more from a moral standpoint, did nothing wrong, but the law is accusing them of doing something wrong, well, then let's deal with the law itself. Then let's put the law on trial, not just protect the criminal or the person being accused in this case of a violation that was not ethically worthy of condemnation. So the thing is that if you're within your right to privacy, and no one can come and say to you, you broke the law, and yes, you were within your privacy zone, you were not affecting anybody else, but you broke the law, you violated somebody else's right, and we're going to punish you for that. That would be unconstitutional. So that's these two pillars have a passive quality to them, meaning that they're inward looking, and if you stay within the proper exercise of the two rights, you cannot be accused of violating anybody else's rights. Whereas with the other three, it is possible. With the right to life, as I'm exercising my freedom, I can, within that exercise, violate the rights of other people. So I can't. No one can say, "Oh, I have the right to life." Like, for example, the right freedom of speech. I have the right to speak freely. That's part of the right to life. And if I use that freedom to slander somebody, to destroy their reputation unfairly, because I have something against them, that I want to get back at them for something. So I just start spewing out a lie, a false rumor, and start saying things about them, and saying that I saw him doing this and saw him doing that when they really weren't doing it. You're exercising your right to life, your right to free speech. But as you're doing that, you're violating the other person's rights, and therefore you cannot say, "Hey, because I was exercising my right to life, you can't come and accuse me of wrongdoing." I hope that makes sense. So, and that's a very important distinction. So that was point number one. The right to property involves the right to acquire property through work and effort, and we just described a little bit the first part of that phrase, the acquiring of property, which falls under mostly the right to life. And the second principle under the right to property that we have described is what we call the Commerce Clause, the right to acquire property through an honest exchange of goods and services. So once a property is mine, it's within my realm of private property, then I can come and exchange it with the private property of somebody else, and I can negotiate, say, "Okay, you give me two of yours, and I'll give you three of mine, and we'll exchange them, and we're good." And that's the Commerce Clause, the right to that sort of exchange. And obviously, this is different from the current Commerce Clause in the current American Constitution, and we went into great details about that in the previous audio clip. And the third principle under the right to property is the right to gift your property to whomever you please, which we can call the charity clause. meaning that if I want to give it away, I don't want to exchange it. I just want to give it away to someone. I have the complete freedom to do so. I can do a transfer even at a loss to me. But if I want to absorb the loss, that's my problem. None of your business. I can do it if I want to. That's part of the right to property. And the fourth principle that we shared before is what we can call the denial clause, the right not to transfer your property to someone else for a price that you do not deem to be fair. And we discussed that in the previous audio clip, the problem with eminent domain in the current U.S. Constitution, where the government can come and take away your property if it needs it for public use. And James Madison, kindly added that we can, we must be given just compensation for it, which is something that is not explicitly said in other constitutions or other legal systems in other countries. So he kindly said, we have to, the government, if they're going to take your property away from you, they can, they must give you just compensation. But, you know, that's very vague. That's all it says in the Constitution, just compensation. What exactly does that mean? And it's usually taken to mean fair market value. And fair market value is the value that that the government, kind of based on the market, decides on it, which takes away from the emotional factors. You know, sometimes, let's say you can have a baseball card of a player. I'm trying to think of Gary Renicky, or John Lowenstein. And those of you who grew up in Baltimore years ago, like I did, would know those names. They were two players who shared, I think, left field. They were they would alternate between games because one was right-handed, the other one was left-handed. And between the two of them, they were powerful. If you combine the stats of both, I think that in 1983, when the Orioles last won the World Series, they had like 40 home runs and 120 RBIs. So it was like they were the MVP of the of Major League Baseball combined. I'm talking about these two individuals, and I'm pretty sure that 99.9% of people out there have no idea who those two players were. But if I have, if I try to sell those baseball cards, might not get too much money for them. You know, the fair, quote, fair market value for those two cards would be minimal. But to me, you know, if I was an Orioles fan and remembering the last time they won the World Series and remember how important these two players were to that team and to the chemistry and the nature, the dynamics of that team, then I wouldn't part with those two cards if you gave me $10,000. When Jimmy Madd said, you know, just compensation, he obviously was saying whatever sentimental value you have for that property is irrelevant to us. If we think it's worth, those two cards are worth, $5, that's what we're going to give to you, even if it's worth $1 million to you, because that's how valuable, how much sentimental value those two players have for you. So even though Jimmy Madd kindly added that phrase, just compensation, it really is a slap in the face the right of the individual to hold property, because it's saying whatever extra value you give, personal value you attribute to that property is irrelevant to us. We're going to take it away from you if we want to. So under this denial clause, basically you are we're saying under the New American Constitution, no. If it's yours, it's yours. If you don't want to give it away, you will not. You will just have to deal with it. And if we as a society are going to suffer because you're holding on to something that we could make use of, then we'll just have to work around you. But we can't take it away from you just like that. And so, and just as a side comment, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking about slavery in the old days, you know, because a lot of what I'm saying sounds like what slaveholders would say back in the South in the old days of slavery. Like, you're not going to take away my property because I own this slave and all that. And the fact that when you start saying that about a human life, it kind of shows that you cannot really include property, a human life as property under the right to property, because you can, as the moment you hold a human life as a property, you're in essence violating their right to life. And it kind of invalidates everything we just said about the right to property. If you exercise the right to property, you can't be violating anybody else's rights. So by that concept alone, you can see very clearly how incongruent it is to own another person as property. And when we do, if we ever get to do an audio clip on slavery in America, we will discuss that in other details. But that's a very important principle. You cannot permanently own someone, another life, because the moment you do that, you break like the whole system, the whole metaphysical system that we're describing here just comes undone. Because then you can, whilst exercising your right to property, violate the right of somebody else. And then you are making this life object person into an object, a lifeless object. And you're denying its right to life, or his or her right to life in this case. So I just wanted to mention that as a side note. And so that was number four, the denial clause. I could deny you the sale of my property if I don't want to sell it, regardless of the price. And the government cannot take that away from us. And that, I think we described briefly before, means that the whole concept of property taxes is shown to yet again be immoral, invalid, unconstitutional from a metaphysical standpoint. Because basically the property tax is saying, hey, it's like we, the government, have kindly allowed you to have possession of this land. You know, what we described as fee simple. That's the legal term for it. So yeah, you can own it. You know, there's an absence of any temporal condition limiting the duration of your ownership of this land. You can own it forever and ever if you live forever and ever. And unless we want to take it away from you for public use, but if we don't want to do that, you can keep that land. We'll kindly let you keep that land, but you're going to have to pay us a fee. And that's feudalism. That's returning to the feudal system. So the government becomes this big lord of the manor who is handing out pieces of land to the serfs, and the serfs are working the land. Yeah, they can keep it, kind of. But they have to give something to the lord of the manor, and that's a violation of this concept. There's that it really was not always yours. It's like you're just renting it, so the property taxes by that alone is invalid. It's like saying, hey, if I exercise my right to property, if I own my house, and I don't pay the property taxes under the current system, you know, that operates in many cities and states across the United States. If I don't pay my property taxes and I own a house, I am breaking the law. And that kind of goes against the idea that, yeah, if you don't do anything with your property, you cannot possibly be breaking any law. If it's just there, if you just have your house there, just by it, the mere fact of its existence as property does not mean that you're then obligated to do something else. You cannot be accused of it breaking any law by the mere passive possession of a property. I hope that kind of makes sense. All right, so now the fifth principle within the right to property is that The right to property is not surrendered except for involuntary abandonment and irremediable restoration. In other words, that I can leave my house with the windows open, the doors open, and everything, and just because I left the house, you know, with full access to any robber, does not mean that the robber has a constitutional right to take my TV, my television, my sofa, and everything inside the house. No, I can. Same with a convertible. If I have a convertible and I have 20 pounds of gold in the back seat of the convertible, just because the top is down and everybody can just reach in and grab the gold bars, does not mean that they have the constitutional right to take my property away. You know, even if I leave the car parked outside, go in to a restaurant, eat there for 2 hours, and come out, those 20 pounds of gold bars should still be there, and I never lost the right of ownership of that property. So I cannot be accused. The police cannot say, hey, no crime was committed here. They took it from your convertible. You had your top down. That's your problem for not being careful. We cannot accuse the robbers of any crime because you gave them open access to your property. That's invalid. And we gave the example of how Lori Bigfoot, the so-called mayor of Chicago, was criticizing some businesses who were looted by black gangs. This Lamborghini place, I think it was, and she was criticizing the owners of the place for not having enough security. So it was their fault that they got robbed, which goes against this principle. We can call it the non-relinquishing clause. You don't relinquish the right to property just by not protecting it. The right to property is inherent there. It's just by sitting there, it still has my name on it. It's like it has this aura around it of my ownership of that property. And if anyone enters into that realm to take it away from me, they are violating a moral and fundamental right. So that's number five. And one thing that we wanted to say about that is that I saw this news story recently about the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, the tax collecting agency in the U.S. The IRS was asking people, and I'm not joking, the IRS was asking people to report their income from theft and other illegal activities for next year. So they were concerned that all the people who did, you know, all the BLM, Boink Babble people, and you know, that's the full correct acronym for BLM, BLM, Boink Babble, Black Lives Matter, but only if not killed by another black life. So whenever BLM, Boink Babble, you know, did all these riots recently, taking advantage of the pandemic and all that, the IRS is concerned that all these merchandise that has been stolen will not get reported properly in the robbers' income tax statements. So they are asking people, literally, say, if you committed a theft and you gained income from theft or other illegal activities, you need to report that in your income tax statement. And I know that's laughable, but it just goes to show how distorted the right to property is under our current system. You can say, oh, it's the liberals doing that. Yeah, but remember, the liberals can do this because the idiotic founding fathers never bothered to describe or define the right to property in any meaningful way within the Constitution or within our legal system at all. So it was always open-ended. So that's why they come up with these stupid things, because no one can say, "Hey, that's that statement from the IRS violates the Constitution because this, that, the other. No one can go to the Constitution and say, hey, that violates this amendment or this clause, because there's nothing to violate. The right to property is basically not there. And just as a side note, even though this thing sounds very ridiculous, it kind of goes back to the 1930s, I believe. What happened was that, as you know, the story about Al Capone, the guy who was the gangster in Chicago, and by the way, Chicago is the capital of evil in the United States, just as a side note. It's the fortress or the stronghold of evil in the United States. That's just a side note there. But the thing is that back in the 30s, I forget when it happened, that Al Capone, or 20s, and he was doing his thing, and you know, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and all that stuff, that the law enforcement agencies wanted to catch this guy, but they couldn't find enough evidence to convict him. So the story goes that, you know, they went the tax route. They decided to accuse him of tax evasion because they were able to show that he was receiving income. He had income and he was not reporting it, and therefore that's how they were able to get him and all that. And that's kind of the root of this, because that kind of meant that, yes, we are basically saying if you're a criminal, then you have to report income from your illegal criminal activities so that we can then come after you Al Capone style, on those grounds. So that's how legally this made sense, that we needed to make sure that it's illegal to evade taxes on illegal income. But the problem is, I think it's just how twisted everything becomes in our legal system, in the American legal system, because of such terrible legal foundations that we have. The concept should not be that. The concept should be, hey, Al Capone is claiming innocence. He's saying he's not committing any illegal activities, because if he, you know, he either is or he isn't. If he is committing illegal activities and he's saying so, then we can come after him and punish him because he just confessed. But if he's not committing illegal activities, and he says he's not committing illegal activities, then by definition, he's claiming that all his income is legal. And that's how you can say then we can accuse you of tax evasion, because you're claiming this income is legal and you haven't paid taxes on it. Hence, we can come after you on those grounds. So instead of creating legality for illegal activities, if that makes any sense. In other words, the government would say, if you steal something, we can tax you on it, and we can try to get you on the grounds of tax evasion. But that is denying that what we said at the beginning, that the property never enters your realm until you have established that the acquisition was done through legal means, that you did not exercise your right to life to violate the rights of others in order to, quote, acquire this property. That money that Al Capone had in the bank was never his. It never was his property to begin with, never. And you can say, well, then we couldn't come after him for tax evasion. No, but it's the argument. If he's saying it's not illegal, then by definition, he has to pay taxes on it. And if he admits it's illegal, then boom, we got him. He just confessed. So we didn't need to legalize illegal income, if that makes any sense, in order to come after them, after criminals for tax evasion. So it's just the muddling of principles. And that's when we completely misunderstand the right to property. If I stole something, it has never become mine. Hence, it can not be shielded by my right to property. I cannot say, oh, you can't touch this. You can't take this away from me because it's mine. No, well, you stole it. It was never yours to begin with. So that's a very important thing. So now let's go into concept number six, related to the right to property, and that would be that. And just as before going into that, and the seventh point is we're trying to describe 7 points or 7 sub-pillars, you could say, within the pillar of the right to property. The first five are positive, you know, that in the sense of protecting your property from anybody else, or protecting your exercise of the right to property. The other two that we're going to say are kind of negative, in the sense that they limit the other five. So we have 5 positive and 2 negative. The 2 negative limit the other five, if that makes sense. So number six, the first negative sub-pillar, is that the Commerce Clause that we described earlier is restricted if the sale contributes to an activity that undermines capitalism and does not add to the real production of goods and services. And you might say, what is he talking about, Willis? Well, basically, what this is trying to say is that it goes to the heart of how the stock market operates at present. And we have discussed this in previous audio clips, that the problem with the stock market is that it creates the secondary zero-sum game market of trading of shares that have nothing that has nothing to do with investment. So if a company releases a share at $100, then the company gets $100, an infusion of $100 into its, you know, equity by selling that share. But once the share is out in, you know, has been released out in the wild, then somebody can buy it and sell it to some other sucker for $120 and make a $20 profit. And then the guy who bought it at $120 can sell it to another sucker for $130 and make $10 profit. But even though the stock is worth, the share is worth $130, the company, the original company, does not see the $30, the extra $30. So when the other guy bought the share for $130, he shelled out 30 extra bucks for that share. But those 30 bucks went into the pocket of the guy who sold him the share, not into the company. He didn't really invest those $30 into a company that is then going to use it to, you know, buy a new chair or buy furniture or buy a new machine or anything like that. It doesn't go into the production process. And that secondary market becomes a drain, and especially by the fact that every time a share is traded, somebody earns a commission. And I heard a story recently, some old story about a guy, a Russian immigrant who lived in Minnesota, who swindled money from a lot of people. And there was this lady that he, you know, was buying stocks for. And the lady said to him, "Hey, don't ever buy anything without consulting with me first." And then she found out that he was buying, you know, and trading stocks with her money without asking her. And the problem was that by him doing so, he was earning a lot of commission on every trade, on every time he sold or bought or did something with her money, he was gaining a commission. So that's why he was doing it without asking her, because he didn't want her to say no. So it creates this very corrupt secondary market where people are just, you know, this is a zero-sum game. If I win, you lose. And it's all going into this zero-sum pot. And on top of that, we have people, you know, leeches collecting a commission on every trade along the way. And nothing is being produced. So we're spending all this money on this fictitious virtual trading that is not contributing to the process of production of actual goods and services. And that's the type of thing that, you know, needs to be constrained in the New American Constitution. And because you could say, well, I bought that stock for $100. If I want to sell it for $120, that's my right. It's my property, and I have the right to do it as I wish. Well, under this principle, the answer would be no. There are certain activities that will be restricted. The Commerce Clause, that right to exchange goods and services however I wish, will be restricted by that condition. If I'm engaging in an activity that is undermining capitalism, when we say undermining capitalism, it means it's draining capital from society, potential capital, money that's claiming to be invested, you know, because everybody says, I'm investing in the stock market. No, you're not investing. Yes, you're investing in the stock market, but you're not investing in the companies in the stock market. You're just investing in this secondary trading melee that goes on. And you're gambling. You're just hoping you buy Amazon stock and you just hope that it will grow in value so that you can sell it off. And it grows in value through perception. If people perceive that Amazon is doing well, then the price is going to go up and then you can sell it off. But it's all about perception. It's this virtual reality game that is disconnected from reality. And it's draining capital because those extra $30 that you paid for that share should have been used instead to put them into a company that will actually do something with that money. So activity that does that sort of thing will be illegal or unconstitutional based on this principle. Because we want to protect capitalism. Protecting capitalism is preventing the growth of activity that will drain capital from society, because then this money is getting invested in this silly game of musical chairs, and then on top of that we have a leech industry of stockbrokers and stock trading companies that are just collecting commission on this merry-go-round, as the every time the merry-go-round goes around, the carousel goes around, they collect another amount of money, another fee, and it's all for naught. We want to prevent that, and I know we are repeating ourselves a little bit, but one of the reasons why the stock market does have a certain place in a way is because it enables investment with liquidity. So I can put in $100 into a company and then get them back by reselling the stock. So I don't have to, in a normal circumstance, if you put $100 into a company, $100 gets sunk into the company, and you can't just go the next day and say, hey, give me my $100 back, because they may have used it to buy some equipment or something, so they can't just give you back your money. But if you're in the stock market, you can go and sell it off, sell your stock off, your share off, and get your money back. So that's the advantage of the stock market. It says, yeah, you can invest with liquidity, but it's really not investment. But we can keep that, have our cake and eat it too. And we describe how we can do that. And we also describe this concept of the virtual stock. As the equity of a company grows, we have to automatically add virtual stocks to the current shareholders. I don't think we'll have time for an example in this audio snippet, but hopefully in the next audio snippet we will repeat an example that we gave, but I guess with better or easier numbers to kind of explain that concept of the virtual stock. So you're going to own literal stock and a virtual amount of stock. Every time there's a new release of stock, of shares into the public, the current shareholders get assigned virtual shares so that the value of the share can stay at $100. And that is going to be like the fixed value for all shares from now until eternity. Every share that's sold in the stock market is worth $100, and it can't be sold for more than that. If somebody wants to sell it for a loss, it's their problem. They can do that if they really need the money and no one wants to buy the share from them. They can sell it off for $86, lose $14, but it's kind of like interest. You know, you're basically just like when somebody pays off, gets a lump sum payment for a lottery winning, it's always less than what they would have gotten if they had just waited for the installments to come in over the years. So it's kind of a way to say, hey, I'm paying $14 just for the privilege of getting money right now because I really need it right now. They can sell it for less than 100, but not for more. And that kind of kills off all this nonsense. All this secondary market of nonsense will just go away. And that means that people will truly be investing in the companies. And if they want to make money, they have to expect dividends from the company. That's the only way to make money off of the shares, not by selling it, because that market would be illegal. And it would only be legal. The only way to legally make money from the shares, but if the company's really producing, which is the, so we are connecting investment with profit more directly. You're investing into a company. If the company has profits because it invested that money properly, then you're going to reap the rewards, the benefits of that, of those dividends. So it's true investment. And it's not volatile. It's not prone to rumors shaking the market, because you can't just go and sell it off at, you know, like crazy, because you're like in the old days, putting money into a company and letting it work until it produces the proper benefit. So so that would be a limitation on the Commerce Clause. And just as a side note, it's important to point out that some people might say, well, you're talking about the zero-sum game that doesn't really produce any goods or services, and that should be banned. Well, doesn't that mean that gambling should be banned as well? Because it's basically the same story. You know, gambling is a zero-sum game. If you sit at a poker table with your buddies and you start playing poker, I've never played poker, so I don't know how that feels. But if you sit with some friends and are playing poker, if you win, you get out, you know, get up from the table at the end of the day of the night with $1,000 more in your pocket. Those $1,000 or $100, let's say it's $100. Because you're playing with some stingy friends, so it's $100 profit, and you know that you got $100 at the end of the night, and those $100 came from all your friends. So all your friends lost a combined total of $100. It's a zero sum game, and nothing, no good or service was produced. But the problem with making the analogy there is that there's a difference, because in gambling there is a service being produced, a subtle service, and the service is the thrill, the enjoyment of playing the game and taking a risk. And you know you might lose, you know you might win, but so it's kind of like a thrill seeking, like bungee jumping, you know, or you know, when people jump off planes, I forget what the name, what's that called, the skydiving or whatever. You're doing it for the thrill of it. And you're taking a risk because, you know, the bungee cord might be a little too long, you know, or the parachute might not open. So you're taking a risk, and it's the thrill of the risk. So that's the service being produced, and you're willing to pay a price. You know, if things don't work out, you're going to end up losing money, but you at least receive the service of this thrilling activity. I'm not a big gambling fan, but the thing is that that is very different, and the context is different. You know you're gambling. And the problem with the stock market works exactly like a gambling operation. It's exactly the same thing. The only thing is that we call it investment, and that's where the lie, that's where the difference is, and that's what's so deceitful about it. People think that they're investing. No, they're gambling. That's what they're doing. It's a different form of gambling. No one calls it as such, and that's why it has to be banned, because it undermines and drains capitalism, and it leads to social consequences. And we've discussed that before, how the stock market crash of 1929 led to the collapse of the American economy, the world economy, and it allowed Polio Boy and people like him to introduce socialism as a means to kind of control people, taking advantage of the crisis to do that. So, and the same thing happened in 2008, because this also applies to house flipping, a practice that happens a lot, and it's become more and more popular, where you buy a house. You're not buying it because you want to live in it. You're just, and you're not like a landlord who's buying these properties and investing and all that. You're just buying because you know you feel in the air a trend, and you will get that house for, you know, a certain amount of money, and you think you're going to be able to sell it off in 2 months and make $10,000 or $50,000 profit. So that's what they call house flipping. So you just buy the house for a short while and sell it off for a profit. But you never intended to live in it. And that is also, would also be prohibited by this sixth condition, this restriction of the Commerce Clause, because it's the same principle. Again, you're not... you're not dealing in activities that produce goods and services intended to reach a final consumer. Every economic activity should either produce or distribute, and distributing means getting the product closer to the final consumer. There's a house. Unlike the stock, in the stock market, there is no final consumer of anything, because there's no one can say, okay, this stock was created so that person B can own it. It's like not like a television set. Television set as the final consumer, the person who finally installs it in his or her living room, plugs it in, and starts watching it. That's the final consumer. That's what the television was built for that one final person who's going to use it. With a stock, with a share, it's not that. The share is just circulating. It's just floating. It never has a final consumer. It was never created for someone specifically. A house does have a final consumer, the person who's going to live in it. But in this case, these house flippers are not distributing, are not entering into the distribution process to help get the house to the right person. They are just in there just for, you know, the in and out kind of thing. It's like commercial fornication. Just go in, get what you want, and then get out. And they have no interest in the house. They couldn't care less what the house looks like. They're just playing a gambling game, just gambling, hoping that they can. But by them introducing themselves into the process, what they're doing is increasing demand and increasing the prices of the houses. So they're increasing the prices and making the house more expensive for the final consumer, because they're injecting artificial demand that shouldn't be there. And as they create this competition, these people fighting for this house so they can flip it, and that increased demand ups the price, and then the final consumer ends up paying more, and they did nothing to get the price, the house, closer to its final consumer. It's not like somebody bought a house and then says, okay, I bought the house, now I'm going to advertise this house and do this, and I have this way of, you know, getting the final consumer, final owner, resident of the house, to be aware of this house, because I have this marketing website where I market the houses I own, and I make it very easy for them to locate the houses I own and so forth. In that sense, you would be getting the house closer to the final consumer. Here, none of that is happening. So all of that house flipping thing would be banned. So in that case, the laws that should be written would mean, according to this principle, would for example, force a house owner to own the house for at least a year or 6 months, and they can sell it off before that at a lower price than they bought it for. If they really need the money again, they can sell it off and say, okay, I give up, and take a loss and get their money back. But if they're really, if they want to make a profit on the house, they have to own it for at least a year or 6 months or some significant period to force them to say, okay, you're committed to this house, and you're not going to participate in this game unless you are really a productive agent of distribution to get the house closer. Because some people could, for example, buy the house and put in they become producers. They put in money, put money into the house to renovate it, to make it look prettier, and then they sell it off. That's different because they are participating in the production process in a legitimate way. So all of these concepts would be embedded in the sixth principle, that the Commerce Clause, the right to exchange goods and services however I want, is restricted if the sale contributes to an activity that undermines capitalism and does not add to the real production of goods and services. And that, you know, in other words, doesn't contribute a legitimate production activity or distribution activity. So that would be number six. There's sub-pillar number seven, but I think we have run way over in this audio clip, audio snippet. So we'll leave it at that and discuss number seven in the future, in the next audio snippet, hopefully. And then we'll, I guess, begin talking about the ninth pillar of the American Constitution. Thank you very much for listening.